Yes, we did roll. As a matter of fact, this is a one-man broadcast, unlike the Paris Review, which I see has about staff equal to the Today Show on television, and it looks like there must be 75 or 80 people plus contributors.
I'm told it's the longest, largest masthead. In fact, I've counted other mastheads to see how it does. Rolling Stone is the only one that beats it. Newsweek is about the same. The New Yorker has only four people on its masthead, and does not include William Shawn, who's the editor.
Well, they probably pay better than the Paris Review.
So there may be some people who are dead on that masthead. We're not really quite sure where they've all gone.
Bernard F. Connors, wasn't he the former FBI guy? He wrote Dance Hall.
That's right. He was a friend of mine in the Army. And came to help the magazine at a time when it was tottering, and he'd made a great fortune in distribution of soft drinks.
In fact,
he's the last man I know who's built his own gatehouse.
I didn't know that. I interviewed him several years ago when he did his novel Dance Hall, but I didn't. I knew he was in the FBI or something, but I didn't know he had done. I didn't know he'd peddled soft.
Well, he's very self-deprecatory about his career, but he's hugely wealthy, and in fact, he just tried to buy a publishing house, Dodd Mead. So he's done very, very well for someone who started out as an FBI investigator.
Well, let's talk about the Paris Review and its origins. Here is the Paris Review, 100 issues for a literary magazine. That certainly speaks well of the Paris Review because literary magazines, the nature of the type of magazines they are very perishable. It began in 1953, apparently in Paris. Tell me how the magazine began.
Well, there was quite a considerable colony of English-speaking people in Paris at that time. It was just after the war, number one. Prices were very low. There were a lot of students there on the GI Bill of Rights. There was really quite a colony. You could live there for $30 a week, in fact, less than that. And as I say, students and people just starting out. So it was a very ripe place indeed to start a magazine. The writers who were there, I can think of a number. Peter Matheson was there at the time, and Harold Humes. They were the two founders of the Paris Review. Evan Cannell, son of the Morning Star author, which has been a big success recently. Max Steele, a lot of English poets and writers. And about three literary magazines started over there at the same time. One called Merlin, which was the sort of Jean-Paul Sartre, Samuel Beckett paper, and there was Ars, and there was a magazine called Points. So it was a very, it was a fertile place at that time for writers and for starting publications of this sort.
Were you living in Paris at the time?
I was actually at Cambridge, studying at Cambridge, England, and Peter Matheson, who's an old friend, novelist of great reputation, had just written his first novel and started this magazine along with his fellow Humes, another novelist, and they needed somebody to be the editor. So I, with previous experience of editing the Harvard Lampoon, they thought that I should know something about putting together a magazine, so they asked me to do it. And I had a year or so to spare, I guess. Never thought it would go on for this long, but I did go to Paris and with them. And
had you at that point finished your work at Cambridge?
Yeah, I just graduated. And as I say, had a couple of years to perhaps fool around before employing myself. And so I agreed to take on this thing. And in the spring of 1953, the first issue came out. We had ideas that I must say interested me about it. One of them was that we were going to try to produce a magazine which devoted itself almost entirely to creative work. Magazines of that sort at the time were dedicated largely to essays, criticism, occasional poem, and maybe one short story an issue. And our idea was to limit the creative, limit the critical work, and concentrate almost entirely on publishing short stories, sections of novels, poetry, artwork, trying to do something different with what had up to that time been rather a drab format, putting in artwork, fancy covers. And so it sounds like a very simple idea, but it was really very much of a departure at that time.
How was issue number one? How does issue number one compare with issue number 100? Format pretty much the same?
It's pretty much the same. The format, the issue number one had a cover in color by William Penn Dubois, who was the son of Guy Penn Dubois, who was a rather distinguished artist of the time. It had the first of an ongoing series of interviews. We decided that if critical work was to be included, that we would go to the writer himself, the famous writer himself, and ask about his work, rather than doing the sort of obligatory essay on the symbolism of his work. If the good writer was alive, we would go and see him and actually ask him about these things. And it happened that the first writer we interviewed of distinction couldn't have been a better choice. It was E.M. Forster, who was in my college at Cambridge King's, this famous, distinguished novelist, who in actual fact had not written a novel since 1924. So obviously the questions that were put to him, and which he answered very gracefully, the question was, why haven't you written a novel since 1924, although you're considered the greatest novelist in the English language? And he talked at great length about this, about the problems of being a novelist and how his characters ran away from him and he couldn't control them, sort of like puppets who had gone askew, awry. And so that was in the first issue, this interview with E.M. Forster.
Were you the interviewer?
Well, two friends of mine at Cambridge were. I sort of sat in, but it is actually signed by two friends of mine. One of them, Ben Haskell, who is rather a distinguished historian at the moment, and a fellow called Shuttleworth. They were the ones who actually did the interview. But it sort of set the... It was the first of a series which used this format of questioners asking questions about the craft of writing to a writer of distinction. And there have been actually 7 volumes of these interviews published over the years, published by the Viking Press, and they really are... It's really a very distinguished series. It has been able to interview Faulkner and Hemingway and Frost and T.S. Eliot and others. So it's had a considerable cachet.
It's more than a cachet. It's a repository of a wealth of information about some of the greatest writers of the past generation. Mm. So it's really, I think, a literary resource more than anything else. Well, now, here you published your first issue in 1953, the Paris Review, issue number 1. English language review in France. How did you peddle it? How did you find an audience?
Well, the other thing we did was that is perhaps an innovation in the literary magazine world. We did peddle it. We had posters made. We put them everywhere in Paris. We spent a great deal of time trying to think of ways that would sell the magazine. And I think because of the contents of that first issue, particularly this E.M. Forster interview, it was picked up by and reviewed by Time magazine and by Newsweek. So from the very beginning, we had an awful lot of luck in terms of announcing its presence. And then in Paris at that time... there were bookstores which would put it in this window. I mean, it was one of the 3 literary magazines in Paris, and I think the bookstore people there took a certain amount of pride in the fact that Paris was once again producing English language publications. Of course, there's been a remarkable history of it. The 20s produced any number of literary magazines during that time. So it was following in a tradition.
Did you have an overseas distribution of the Paris Review at that time?
Well, it was small. Most of the distribution was here.
I meant it's published in Paris, but it was aimed for the American market.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I would guess that our total distribution in Europe was something like 500 copies. Here it was 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 copies, and it's fluctuated, but not really very much. I think there's sort of a limited audience with this sort of magazine, and the most you could hope to sell would be about 15,000, and it fluctuates around 10.
Sold primarily through the mail, by subscription?
Sold by subscription. I'd guess half of the copies are sold through bookstores and the other half by subscription.
When did the magazine eventually emigrate to the United States?
Well, we had an editor here from the very start, Tom Ginsberg, who became the publisher of the Viking Press. He sort of set up an office here and a distribution system. And then I came back after about 4 years and started teaching and opened up an office here. And the office stayed in Paris until, I guess, the early 70s. We had a series of Paris editors. Bob Silvers, who is now the editor of the New York Review of Books, was an editor there for a while. Blair Fuller, who's a teaches in San Francisco. A fellow called Patrick Bowles, who was Samuel Beckett's secretary. He was the editor in Paris for a while. Fred Seidel, a very distinguished poet. Nelson Aldrich, who became an editor at Harper's. All of them took sort of two-year stints, and the final editor was a young woman named Maxine Grofsky, who now runs a literary agency here. And she was there for about 6 or 7 years, and when she finally decided to come back, we closed up the Paris office. It had really become sort of an outpost. And the publication of the magazine, the actual printing of the magazine, which was done in Nijmegen in Holland, also came back here, and we now print in a printing plant in New Hampshire. So the whole thing has moved back. And it was really a necessity because Paris changed considerably. It got very expensive. The writers who were there on the GI Bill of Rights came home. The only writer who stayed on was James Jones, who could afford to. He sort of was the center of a great scene there. But there were mostly people, they were mostly transients. It became really very expensive to live in Paris. So the magazine has been back in the States, and back in the States here for really a decade now.
Now, the role of the publisher, I see the first, the founding publisher was the Aga Khan. I would assume that the publisher's role, in effect, is to bankroll the magazine.
Well, you've hit it right on the button. We've had four publishers. The first was Sadruddin Aga Khan, who was the second son of the famous old gentleman, the fellow who used to weigh himself in jewelry, platinum, and so forth, and was a friend of mine.
How did one become friends with the Aga Khan?
Well, he was at Harvard. He was a... I knew him in Europe. We went to Spain, followed the Bulls.
Was one of the boys then.
Yeah, and absolutely wonderful fella, and very understanding of what our problems were. And, of course, in those days, in the 50s, it wasn't a great drain on anybody's pocketbook to run a literary magazine. All of us worked for practically nothing. The contributors got paid not anywhere near what they should have been paid, and so he was the he became the publisher. In fact, I asked him to be the publisher while running, indeed before the Bulls in Pamplona. That was one of the things everybody did then. And suddenly, as the rocket went up, which indicated the Bulls were in the streets, running up towards the Bull Ring. It's about a 2 mile run, as I recall, maybe a bit more, and you start halfway and the Bulls run twice as fast as you do, so that when you get to the Bull Ring, you're just about there at the same time. And during this run, I thought to ask him if he would like to become the publisher of the Paris Review. And without thinking a great deal about it, because there was a lot more he had on his mind, he said he would be delighted to be this. So he was the publisher for about 10 years, and then went on to become the High Commissioner for Refugees in the United Nations, and now runs a sort of a think tank on the shores of Lake Geneva for the problems of the world. And the second publisher was Bernard F. Connors, who was a friend of mine in the army in Italy, and made a fortune in bottling in the distribution of soft drinks after having originally been an FBI agent. He, terribly successful man, and he decided he wanted to write, and I gave him some help, and in return he became the publisher of the magazine for a while. And then the third publisher was a rock musician and composer, lived down the street, wrote a fellow called Ron Dante, wrote that piece called Sugar Sugar, and made a great fortune out of that, and saw that we were in trouble, and offered to be the publisher for a while. I think he was the publisher for about 5 or 6 years, and the present publisher is a young woman, Deborah Pease, who is the only one of the publishers who is actually a literary person. She writes poetry and has written a novel, a very very good one, and reads the publication. I think all the others did, but it wasn't as much of a surprise to it's not as much of a surprise to her as it was to them.
Does the Paris Review earn money?
No. It doesn't lose a great deal, but what money we do make, we try to pay the contributors.
That alone makes the Paris Review stand out, because I understand most literary magazines just can't do that.
Yes, if they make payments, they're very nominal. But we pay $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 for a short story, which is a lot. And we try to pay the people who do the interviews, and we pay the poets. I can't remember what it is per line now, but it's as much as any poetry magazine pays. And for special features, we pay just as much as we can afford. I would guess that almost every penny that comes into the magazine, short of the printing costs, goes into paying contributors.
Well, on your masthead, you've got a variety of editorial assistants, contributing editors, consulting editors, advisory editors. What do all these people do? What do the advisory editors do?
Well, in theory, they advise. The reason the masthead is enormous, and it is, there are more people, I think there are over 100 on that masthead, and I'm not sure that it isn't the largest. I know that there are very few magazines, even mass circulation magazines, which have more. Rolling Stone, I think, has more people on its masthead. And the reason is that about the only way we can compensate a great many of the people who come and work for the magazine is to put them onto that huge board, and perhaps so that they can carry it in their curriculum vitae. It's hard to get on, but once you get on, we never take you off. We tried to streamline it once. People who would never, I hadn't heard from in years and years, and yet editors who have worked on the magazine, it's the first thing they look to see if they're still on it. So it's better to keep them on it and keep them happy and hope that they will contribute one day.
And, of course, with all those people in the masthead, it's pretty easy to assemble a party when you want to.
Well, that's for sure. Some of them may have gone the way of all flesh. It gets larger. It doesn't get smaller, that masthead, no matter what happens to the people who are on it.
Now, at the top, there are a number of people listed as editor, including Peter Matheson, who was one of the founding people. But you're at the top, so I guess you, in effect, are like the managing editor? Literary editor?
Well, I think there are five names up there at the top, and I'm really the only one who... It's sort of like a law firm. You know, it's like... Or Scudder, Stevens, and Clark. I don't think it's like a financial firm. It's like the names you find on the door, and you go in there, and none of the people are alive or are there. Of the people at the top, I'm the only one who really plays a very, very active role. I mean, it's something that I do every day. Peter Matheson is a naturalist and a novelist and teaches at Yale. And every once in a while, a story from one of his students will come in. In fact, one came in yesterday. Blair Fuller, who was one of the people on the top there, occasionally sends in stories from San Francisco. Bob Silvers, who is now the editor of the New York Review of Books, obviously has that paper to contend with. But from time to time, he calls up or we have lunch and he suggests something. I don't know who's on there. Donald Hall, I think, is up there. He was the original poetry editor of the Paris Review, and once in a while I get a letter from him advising.
You handle the fiction primarily, is that correct?
Yes, I handle pretty much the fiction and the interviews. Jonathan Galassi is the poetry editor, very much his own turf, his bailiwick. The art editor is Richard Morgan, who was Richard Marshall, rather, who was a curator at the Whitney. And he pretty much decides what the artwork, what the cover is going to look like. So the magazine is compartmentalized to a degree. And then there's a managing editor, Jay McCulloch, who's been with the paper for 3 or 4 years now, and she sort of organizes things and looks to the that the magazine is printed properly and proofread and so forth.
Actually, the Paris Review is operated on the first floor of your townhouse. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. Funny little office. It has I don't think it looks like any other office in magazine history. It's a really a very small place for all these people to be crammed in. The whole masthead isn't crammed in there, but there are about five people who come in every day to read manuscripts, to sort them out. One of the great pleasures, of course, about doing a magazine like this is that every once in a while, something comes in, either unsolicited or through an agent, which really makes all this worth publishing, worth doing.
Do you read everything?
I don't. The readers do that, and they pick out the pieces which they think will interest me or interest one of the other editors.
Do you encourage material from readers?
Not so much. Well, I think that there have been people who have a number of writers who have published a number of pieces in the Paris Review, whose work we champion, and who tend to think of us when they finish a short story or a piece of a novel. Very likely they will send it to us.
But you would not encourage unsolicited material?
We do.
You do?
I think, yes, and I think it's very important that we do, because some magazines just refuse to receive unsolicited material. They'll send it back without even opening it. But since the Paris Review is devoted to publishing the work of unknown, emerging writers, it really behooves you to open up everything that comes in, over the transom, the phrase for it is. And we have published a number of things which were unsolicited.
Of course, with only 4 issues a year, you must have to, just by the very nature of the limitations in the publishing schedule and the amount of material that you can get into an issue, you must have to turn down a lot of stuff.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And most of the stuff that comes in, sadly, is not really worth the, hardly worth the paper it's printed on. I mean, everybody thinks they can write. An awful lot of people do at any rate. So we get about 200 or 300 or 400 manuscripts a week.
Now, wait a minute. I recall the story about you receiving a contribution from John Irving that was rejected, I think, under your name, as I recall. I can't remember this little anecdote, but it was rejected, and it turned out to be an excerpt from The World According to Garp.
Every once in a while, I didn't reject it. If I'd seen it, I think I would have known enough to have taken it. I asked him for something. He's a friend, great friend of my cousin, and I met him at my cousin's wedding, and he'd written 2 or 3 novels before, and I asked him if he would send something in. No, I didn't read it. It was read by the managing editor, and she sent it back with a letter saying that it was too reminiscent of Pynchon. And it's the Marva section in The World According to Garp. Oh, we've certainly sent back things that we probably should have published.
Probably it's good when things are sent back that if there are any comments, they're expressed in a very vague way, just in case, unless it's an obvious travesty of literature.
Well, we have two rejection slips. One is called the A slip, and that is simply an outright rejection. It says something like, we are unable to accept your contribution at this time, or whatever. And then the other one is more polite, saying that the work has interested us and that we would like to see more. And then if the piece comes awfully close and it's been discussed by the editors, then somebody, Mona Simpson, who's one of the editorial board, will sit down and write a letter, or I will, in which we criticize the piece perhaps, or perhaps ask for changes or make some suggestions about it and plead to see more.
I've heard complaints that it's, I'm not sure this is valid anymore, but I've heard complaints that it's impossible for good literature to become published in magazines because there aren't the big general magazines there used to be. But I'm not quite certain that is the case as I think about it. Now, there may not be a Saturday Evening Post or a Collier's, but it seems to me that we have a lot of magazines to draw on, and not all of them, of course, pay the way the Saturday Evening Post used to pay, but seems to me with university presses and little presses, you go down to the Gotham, you go into that back room, just see hundreds, it looks to me, hundreds and hundreds of small literary magazines. I'm not sure. It seems to me the climate is not too bad for literature today.
Well, I'm afraid most of those publications that you see there are really affairs of the heart with very, very small circulations. You have to hope, really. And most of them are poetry. I don't know of many magazines that publish fiction. It's fairly easy to put together a broadsheet of poetry, 20 or 30 or 40 pages. But when you have to print a 60-page or a 50-page, 40-page short story, the allotment of money that you have to publish that thing is gone with one piece. So most of those magazines are poetry reviews, poetry magazines. I don't know. I think it's probably the fiction writer, serious fiction. I think he has a lot of problems, unless he's working on a novel. I don't know where I would send a short story if I wrote one. Harper's publishes them, that's true. Esquire does. The Atlantic usually publishes a couple an issue.
You can't forget the New Yorker. They publish more than any of them.
And the New Yorker. But still, when you count the number of people who are trying to make their living or trying to do something with serious fiction. I have a theory that there are probably 120,000 people who enjoy reading serious fiction. It's been pretty much a stable numbers for years and years and years.
Well, I'm shocked when I hear of a limited edition by a famous writer that is printed in 100 copies. Now, Raymond Carver does a lot of signed, limited, numbered editions. And John Irving has done... Well, no, I'm not sure about Irving. He did... I guess his last book was done by the Franklin Mint, which God knows how many copies they published of that. That was, I believe that was the Hotel New Hampshire. But a lot of very famous writers, even Styron, William Styron, has done a number of limiteds of little essays and things he's written. But they're printed in 100 copies, and you would think, you know, a writer like Styron, who Sophie's Choice sold in the millions, you would think that people would gobble these little books up. But of course, they're expensive, $35, $45.
Yes, I think those are probably for collectors of first editions and the bibliophiles and people of that nature that do that.
But still, I mean, you would think that 100 copies would sell out, and yet they always seem to be available if you read these rare book dealers' catalogs that I get. And they always seem to be in there, and you always wonder about them. One of 100 issues.
Yeah, well, as I say, I think those are specialized specialized audiences.
You began with Paris Review in 1923, and rather 1953, and here it is 23 years since. Have you noticed any changes in the way in literature, in the way stories are written, and their direction, their aim?
Well, the choices have been so eclectic with the review, it's very hard to say. We've never really believed in isms, if you will. And so, and there's such a difference, even if you pick up one issue of the Paris Review and the type of material that's in there. I have not seen a direction. People seem to think that stories are much better written than they used to be, perhaps because of the writing courses and the college courses and so forth, and the colonies and the summer writing programs, so that what gets published seems to have a flair of people of craft about it. But I've not noticed any vast changes. I'm now putting together an anthology of the best from the Paris Review, and when you go back and look at stories that are written 20 years ago, the ones that are good seem to have that flair, that use of language which catches your eye, just as the ones today do. Well, themes are slightly different, obviously.
One thing I've noticed, I'm not sure if this is so much directed in the short story because of the nature of the publications that they appear in, but there certainly is a lot more explicit language and sex in modern fiction today than there ever could have been in the 50s when the post office would have headed off that material. So you can pick up any number of highly regarded novels, literary novels, and read explicit material in there that you never would have seen 23 years ago.
Well, that's absolutely true. And it's particularly true with the Paris Review, because we not only had to deal with the post office, we had to deal with the customs. And the customs here in New York, had a gentleman called Mr. Dempsey. I've never forgotten him. And I used to, when the issue came in from being printed in Holland, I used to go down to him and argue over the stories. And he had a sort of a Mr. Everyman who had two children. He used to talk about the person in whose hands the Paris Review must not get. And it was a family. I used to try to tell him that the typical reader of the Review was a lonely, a misanthrope Vermont farmer who had no children and was trying to write himself, and read the Paris Review only to burn it instantly because he didn't like anything in it. And his idea was that the reader was a sort of a family man with children, and if they got their hands on this stuff, it could infect them in some terrible way. And there was one issue of the Paris Review which arrived on the docks, and there was a dock strike coming up, and I pleaded with him to let the thing go through. And he said, was there anything in it that would upset me? And I said, I didn't think so. And he then read it that night, and there was a four-letter word in there to show you how carefully Mr. Dempsey read these things to make sure that he was protecting the American reader. And he was absolutely outraged. He tried to get the marshals out to bomb this issue and destroy it, and it wasn't until a decision came from Washington that we were allowed to let this thing out. So you're right, there's a much more expressive use of language in the stories. But in terms of theme, in terms of craft, I don't really see that much difference.
That's an interesting story about the customs man, because I remember in my early days of broadcasting, late 50s, early 60s, my immediate superior and I used to argue vehemently over censorship, and he would say, I don't want you to read such and such. I don't want you to have that. It shouldn't be printed because it might get in the hands of my children. Same story. And my answer would always be, well, don't let your children get their hands on it. The problem with the attitude of your customs man and the attitude of my immediate superior, who I actually had was very fond of, was they would prevent everybody from reading it in order to protect a few. And you just can't get away with that today, I don't think, although it seems to me from what I've been reading, wasn't this obscenity panel of the Attorney General's going to have some sort of permanent committee to make recommendations about what was obscene and have a standard list of magazines that certain stores should not publish? I just hope that...
Well, I think it still comes down to the community. I don't think that Washington would dare fiddle with something like that, but... Green Bay, for an example, in this last election, had out in Wisconsin, had a proposition on their voting, which would have elected a panel, a police panel, I believe, to review the books, review magazines, and so forth. It was voted down by the good burghers of Green Bay.
That's not a bad idea, you know. That way you'd have at least one reader in Green Bay. You'd have to read it, right?
Well, we had the one Paris Review. There was a fellow who was a member of the John Birch Society out in Farmingdale, Long Island, and they had a meeting there in the school library, and this fellow leaned back, and he put his hand behind his shoulder to pick a book out, and it turned out to be a copy of the Paris Review. And he found a word in there which was not to his liking, and he removed the book from the library so that it would stay out of the hands of the electorate, and the library brought a suit against him, and he was found guilty. So that fight continues. I mean, that wasn't all that long ago.
Well, it's still a comforting feeling knowing that there are people out there who are going to protect us and our sensibilities.
That's nice to have people who read something very carefully like that.
I mean, that too, but let them know that they're watching over us to make sure that we're not harmed in any way. You know, it's good to have some paternalism in Washington. Well, it was delightful chatting with you about the Paris Review and its origin. By the way, what is the circulation?
Well, it's about 12,000. It goes, sometimes it sneaks down to 10, and sometimes we have a special issue. The 100th issue, for example, is a great big fat thing that has over 400 pages in it. And then sometimes we have issues that have particularly interesting features. The number 18 had an interview with Ernest Hemingway in it, which was the first time that author had talked to an interviewer. So we published a great number of those. There are a great number left of that particular issue in my grandmother's garage, in my mother's garage. So if anybody wants the issue number 18, which has Philip Roth's first short story in it, The Conversion of the Jews, it has the Ernest Hemingway interview in it, I'd be perfectly delighted to help clear out my mother's garage, because there are an awful lot of them in there.
And I assume that the Paris Review at the better bookshops, it's available there, and of course always available through the mail.
Yes, people should write to me, 541 East 72nd Street, and we'll supply them with a subscription to the Paris Review. By doing that, they will help writers, I think, and help the future of people who are thinking about writing and have great talent and cannot find a place to get the stuff published.
It's a wonderful literary magazine, and I've been reading it off and on, not since 1953, but for many years, and I certainly appreciate that you bicycled in and the cold weather and filled me in on the origins of the Paris Review. George Plimpton, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.